its emancipatory content nor of the administrative apparatus' attempt to repress its revolutionary aspirations. Rather, it is a consequence of some of the more paradoxical features of the theory itself. First, its attempt to conceal its Marxian characters, and subsequently, in its American face, its effort to prevent its instrumentalization by those very forces that the theory had sought to oppose. Page Roman 14. Here I am focusing only on the main contributions of the Institute, the work of Horkheimer, Adorno, and to a lesser extent Marcuse. The choice of a deliberately obscure mode of expression was not merely an unavoidable byproduct of either the complexity of the phenomena they choose to investigate or of their theoretical heritage, but was inextricably linked with the problematic character of their attempt to create a theory of emancipation in a context where all organized or organizable opposition had long since capitulated. Within such a predicament, to make the theory conceptually accessible through the reified language of the logic of domination would have meant to expose it to instrumentalization by the same administered a society against which it was aimed. Thus, internal complexity and obscurity were to be themselves guarantees that the process of decoding explosive theoretical contents would shatter the reification result from automatic readings and conceptual commodification. It is precisely this dilemma, which is also that of a large body of modern art, which provides the key to understanding the full trajectory of the Frankfurt School from Horkheimer's takeover of the Institute's directorship in 1931 to its eventual dissipation in the late 1960s. That the attempt to refurbish a critical Marxian theory was made in the face of the disappearance of its potential audience explains the generally unenthusiastic reception of critical theory, both by an academic community deemed by the theory itself to be relatively irrelevant and undergoing increasing criticization in its face of technocratic rationalization, and by a broader public sphere of whose existence critical theory itself constituted a prolonged obituary. In short, the theory ruled out any reception other than the one which it actually received. To further complicate things, this paradoxical state of affairs tended to become ontologized in such a way that the political impotence is presupposed was turned into a theoretical virtue, and all possible alternatives tended increasingly to be ruled out in principle. Ultimately, critical theory was forced to justify itself in terms of a future emancipation, which was otherwise shown to be unrealizable. Page Roman 15. Adorno's final antagonistic confrontation with those very students that he himself had helped to radicalize typifies the unfortunate political corner into which critical theory had managed to paint itself. It tended to help create an explosive audience, which it had to subsequently diffuse, not just on the basis of intrinsic shortcomings, but on what ultimately were ontological grounds. Contrary to left conventional wisdom, according to which the quandaries of critical theory are the result of its having jettisoned fundamental Marxist assumption, the real problem was the exact opposite, the unwarranted retention of too much traditional Marxist baggage. Initially operating inside a framework that promised a socialist pot of gold at the end of the capitalist rainbow, early critical theorists, particularly Horkheimer, up to the late 1930s, could only see fascism as the infamous last stage of capitalism, and Stalinism, despite all of its internal shortcomings, as a transitory stage to authentic socialism. And even after the theoretical shifts of the early 1940s, footnote 1, text, and Adorno's official joining of the inner group, footnote 2, text, their analysis of American society remained caught within its framework, minus the happy ending, since dialectic of enlightenment had successfully exploded the earlier myth of historical progress toward a necessarily emancipatory socialism, the future became immensely more problematic. Adorno was no longer able to articulate concrete social theory, as Lukács had, by relating to a totality, or rather to the totalizing act of an identical subject-object. Footnote 3. Text. As early as 1931, Adorno had rightly understood that the collapse of the proletariat's role as the tendential totalizing subject-object of history rendered the concept of totality problematic. Footnote 4. Text. Unwilling at that point to radically revise the Marxist philosophy of history, critical theorists had gradually turned to psychoanalysis to explain the collapse of potential proletarian opposite while safeguarding lingering emancipatory promises in the biological dimension. Footnote 5, text. This explains why Marcuse's one-dimensional man and Adorno's minima moralia exists as two antinomic yet complementary theories of American society. Marcuse stubbornly continued theorizing on the macrological level in a fashion apparently ruled out by the collapse of the Lukashian project, a collapse which had left no suitable collective epistemological foundation, immune from the pitfalls of a theory positioning the mythological identity of subject and object. Page Roman 16. For Adorno, on the other hand, social theory was possible only by escaping into aesthetics, where micrological analysis of the particular provide aphoristic glimpses of that false totality no longer immediately apprehensible through discredited traditional conceptual means. Where Marcuse's macrological approach leads him to narrate a story which cannot have a happy ending, which accounts for his subsequent frenzied search in the social periphery for potential revolutionary subjects, Adorno's micrological analysis succeeds in salvaging revolutionary objectivity in social theory as art, but at the price of destroying any possible normative political mediational function. Nevertheless, their shared reception of psychoanalysis allows both Marcuse's and Adorno's analysis to complement each other within an antinomic framework which, in spite of irresolvable dualism, still aspires to remain dialectical. In attempting to rescue the Marxist philosophy of history from the theoretical ruins of history and class consciousness, Horkheimer's and Adorno's use of psychoanalysis successfully destroyed the dialectic and eventually resulted in dialectic of enlightenment, which constitutes the most far-reaching revision of precisely that Marxist philosophy of history that it was meant to preserve. In short, the psychoanalytic turn led to the ontologizing to the socio-historical predicament of American society in transition from entrepreneurial to advanced capitalism, understood as a new state-regulated social formation, with the result that the historicity of this transitional phase was altogether ignored. Thus, when the crisis of one-dimensionality erupted, it became impossible to theoretically grasp the nature of the new developments. In Adorno's, especially, the dialectic becomes dehistorized to cover the whole of Western civilization as the genesis of the domination of the concept. Consequently, critical theory does not even attempt to prefigure the future of elaborating the mediation necessary to bring it about and become purely defensive. It ultimately retreats to defend particularity, autonomy, and non-identity against an alleged, totally administered society where thinking itself appears as a dispensable luxury. To the extent that the politicization of the productive process and the development of the cultural industry leads to the colonization of consciousness, thus systematically ruling out any form of internal opposition, the logic of domination unfolds unchecked toward the even more disastrous manifestation of Auschwitz, the Gulag, and Hiroshima. Page 17. The psychoanalytic theory of socialization and the analysis of the totally administered society combine to checkmate all the remaining hopes of social emancipation. In the late 1950s, critical theory becomes increasingly hermetic, with its analysis of one-dimensionality becoming the pervasive theme except for occasional detours through politically impotent aesthetic maneuvers. The subject disappears. Society becomes all-powerful and intellectuals can only escape into obtrusiveness and isolation to avoid harmonization, instrumentalization, or in extreme cases even annihilation. Paradoxically, that this account ended up losing was precisely that non-identity which it sought to preserve. Instead, it embalmed and reified it within an increasingly rigid and objectivistic reproduction of the given that has already been frozen by the all-pervasiveness of the concept. Also, this aphorism retain their critical edge by escaping into a poetic mode of discourse. When Adorno attempts to defend critical theory against positivist adversaries, he let the orthodox Marxist cat out of the bag. On the macrological level, the totality remains an absolutely irreplaceable category. The model of exchange rationality remains the basic principle of modern society, and the economic crisis theory looms on the horizon. Large chunks of traditional Marxist doctrine resurface, wholly unaffected by the aqua regia of critical theory. Legitimate by psychoanalysis, they remain unchallenged even by the overthrow of the Marxist philosophy of history, whose rescue had originally required the introduction of the psychoanalytic dimension. Also operating on different levels, Marcuse's one-dimensional man ultimately spells out what Adorno's Minima Moralia merely alludes to. Both approaches eventually converge on a similar pessimistic evaluation of emancipatory prospects. The theoretical trajectory that is usually understood as mature critical theory, fully elaborated during the 1950s and early 1960s as the completion of analysis, began in 1940 and typified by Dialectic of Enlightenment, brilliantly captures the Cold War period. The plastic 1950s and in general the post-New Deal American society, which was rapidly hegemonizing most of the world. Page Roman 18. It was unable, however, to foresee or come to grips with what Habermas in Legitimation Crisis, footnote 6, text, calls the rationality or planning crisis, which looms as the fundamental